Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming back at you with another true crime puzzle to solve. In this episode, we're examining the December 5th, 2015 disappearance of Caitlin Akins in Virginia. Caitlin Akins, back in 2015, is a 19-year-old young woman living in Arizona with her fiancé Amber, who was about 21 at the time. Amber had lived in Virginia years earlier, where she met Caitlin, and the two developed a strong friendship that eventually grew into something romantic. In their teen years, Amber's family left Virginia for Arizona, meaning that Caitlin and Amber remained in a long-distance relationship. Yet Caitlin was eager to change that, so, combined with her dislike for school, she was motivated to work really hard to get out into the real world as soon as possible. Depending on the source, Caitlin, who is obviously very bright, either graduates 2 years early or gets her GED so that she never has to follow through on the 2 full years of high school remaining. Caitlin's professional goal at the time is to go to cosmetology school, and her love of all things expressive and creative is apparent in her constantly changing hairstyles and colors, along with various piercings. By 18, she was determined to move to Arizona to live with Amber and planned to attend school out there. They got engaged. As always, there was a trade-off in doing that, as Caitlin was close to her family for the most part. You see, she never seemingly had a relationship with her father, who was never married to her mother Lisa, and so Caitlin's stepfather James filled that role to a certain extent. According to some, however, Caitlin found James creepy at times, and though it's not known if he ever attempted to physically abuse her, at least one account suggests he was perhaps verbally abusive. Yet, at the time of Caitlin's disappearance, James was already living elsewhere, in rural Partlow, Virginia, perhaps a half-hour drive from the family's home in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and a divorce from Lisa was underway, if not already completed at the time. Now, Caitlin is scheduled to start cosmetology school in Arizona on December 7th, 2015, and needs her high school diploma, or the equivalent GED, to enroll. So she could have just had her mom send it to her from Virginia, but it just so happens that Caitlin's sister had a baby a couple of weeks earlier back home, and Aunt Caitlin, who loved kids, didn't want to miss an opportunity to meet the newborn. So Caitlin plans to fly out to Virginia on December 1st and return to Arizona on the 5th, giving her several days in which she can not only visit with family, but also her friends before starting school back in Arizona on the 7th. On the evening of December 3rd, after spending time with family and meeting her nephew that week, Caitlin gets together with some friends from high school. Everybody seems to have a lot to drink. One thing leads to another, and soon enough, an invitation for Caitlin to stay overnight turns into a threesome with another couple. Now, according to Caitlin's mother, Caitlin had cheated on people in the past, and it also seems she was very open-minded in terms of her partner's sexuality, as she had been involved with both men and women, or boys and girls, given her age. So, for some people, indulging an event of this sort might be traumatic upon waking up the next day and realizing the implications. But I get the feeling that even though this might have been upsetting for her, it wasn't so out of bounds from her normal behavior that she'd be mired in guilt and ashamed about it beyond the offense it would cause Amber to learn the truth. I don't think this is something that's going to cause her to crumble. I mean, yes, they're engaged, but they're also 19, and it isn't uncommon in any way for an independent, open-minded young adult to engage promiscuity. So, given that her mother says she cheated in the past, and it's obvious she was able to handle those situations, there isn't any reason to believe that this particular indiscretion is going to send her over the edge psychologically in the aftermath. People who have cheated in the past don't suddenly have unbearable guilt. So before we even get into the details here, I would preclude psychological ailments as a possibility for Caitlin's disappearance. This is definitely a case of foul play. but I'm getting ahead of myself. Now December 5th arrives, the day Caitlin is scheduled to fly back to Arizona. She needs a ride to Ronald Reagan Airport, but her mom has to work all day. So mom suggests that Caitlin should ask her stepfather James for a ride instead. Lisa's home is approximately a 1 hour drive from the airport, and James lives even farther away, perhaps an hour and a half. So James agrees, and Lisa plans to drive Caitlin to his home before work. Now, look at the odd logistics involved here. Caitlin has enough friends to have a threesome, and probably a lot more too, as she grew up locally, so why can't any of them take her to the airport? Maybe they were busy. It was a weekday. Yet, if Caitlin found her stepfather James creepy to the extent that she made no effort to visit a man who had lived in her house as a father figure growing up, one that her mother obviously divorced for a good reason, we assume, why are these women creating a situation in which Caitlin and James will be alone together in a rural place for several hours with nothing to do? I'm not judging, but this doesn't make any sense to me. Lisa makes a half-hour drive with her daughter that morning to get to James's house, taking Caitlin even 30 minutes farther away from the airport. Yet the airport was only 1 hour away from her home. If Lisa simply got up a little bit earlier, Caitlin would have a ride to the airport, even if the wait was long. But instead, she chooses to be alone on a 90-minute drive with her creepy stepdad, after having taken that ride with her mother. That logic is absolutely ludicrous, and I'm definitely not saying that as criticism. The point is this. Delusional people who want things they can't have look for weak links in your logic, places in which it seems like what they want is actually true and that they can have it. The point is that if you open the door even a crack to validate that notion, then it becomes okay in their minds to proceed. Think of it this way. If you're a guy and a woman you're attracted to seems to go out of her way to get near you, and in a situation intended for the two of you to be alone, you're going to run with that idea because it gives you hope that you're correct. She intentionally uses poor logic to manipulate a circumstance in which you end up closer to each other, and often it's an unspoken, silent message that says, make a move, right? This is how we tell each other things in the absence of words. Sometimes this plays out like magic, and other times it ends with a man being humiliated because he read the cues incorrectly or they were disingenuous and he wanted to believe it was more than flirting. But in the worst cases, those involving obsession, an embarrassment of this sort leads to violence like rape and murder. This type of situation is most dangerous when a man who has desired a woman for a very long time is so desperate that he will frame anything even remotely conforming to such logic as a message from the woman that she really wants him. That idea can become corrupted to the greatest extent in situations involving family, and especially children, as it's not only illegal and immoral, but taboo to indulge relations of a sexual nature inside the family between parent and child. Yet, the relationship we know is most dangerous in terms of potential is the relationship between step-parent and child, and more specifically, or more often, a stepfather, as he is biologically removed from the equation as being the father. So, if you were a man who was attracted to your stepdaughter when she was underage and in your home, but had no opportunity to confront her because of the presence of others, and also knew she was promiscuous, then reuniting with her alone after she crosses the threshold of adulthood at age 18, and in a situation in which she seems to be indulging manipulated logic to get near you without anyone else around, would lead to rationalizing that she finally wanted to get with you. No, it wouldn't be true, but that's the point. It only needs to seem like it's true in order for him to justify his actions. Now, you might ask, well, why would someone utilize such strong denial in the process of believing that something is going to end well and just like he planned, when it's obvious that isn't going to happen? Well, most of the time, the denial these people are grappling with is not in relation to making their move, but in the possibility of rejection. If you're doing this, it probably means that when the time comes and she says no, you're likely to not take that no for an answer and proceed to use rape and murder to suffice. I mean, let's get real. If a girl's stepfather hits on her sexually, most of the time, this type of advance is going to be unwelcome and in the strongest terms possible. So if you're James on December 4th and you get a call directly from Caitlin asking to create a situation in which the two of you will be alone together the next day, and one in which sound logic has been abandoned without good reason, you're potentially going to see that as an opportunity to make your move and also convince yourself that it's what she wants too. The idea here is that, ultimately, what these predators know is that they're likely going to precipitate a situation that doesn't render consensual sex. Rather, it's going to end with sexual assault and murder. In that circumstance, what often happens is that the perpetrator, believing he's going for consensual sex, convinces himself when it all goes wrong and he gets rejected that he had no choice to kill her. That's what he's setting up. He tells himself it isn't what he intended, and if she didn't lead him on only to reject him, then none of this would have happened. It's simply a way of projecting fault onto the victim for leading him to believe she wanted his affection before abandoning him and refusing to provide that affection. He tells himself that she teased him, and so he just took what was promised. Now, if that sounds really childish, that's exactly where the concept originates. Women, as mothers, show their sons love and affection in childhood, but when a heterosexual male grows to adolescence and beyond, requiring greater needs in relation to sexuality, his mother abandons him on that front out of necessity, or rejects him, meaning that those sexual needs are met elsewhere by an unrelated woman. So when a man seeks the sexual attention of a biologically unrelated woman and is rejected, he becomes angry because he did exactly what mom insinuated would work, and it failed, which means in his head that all women are part of a conspiracy in which men are forced to leave the affection of their mothers for the sexual attention of other women who also, ironically, refuse them like their mothers, leaving them stuck between and alone. So, Caitlin gets dropped off at her stepdad's house on the 5th, taking her much farther away from the airport than she would have been at her mom's house. James, of course, is going to wonder why, which is perfectly innocent as a logistical consideration. But if this person has had an obsession with his stepdaughter, specifically from a sexual standpoint, what's going to happen is he's going to see this as an attempt to not only get close to him, but to do it alone. And that won't happen because it's what she's really doing. It will happen because it's what he needs to believe. Now, James, of course, has not been charged or found guilty of any wrongdoing in this case, but I don't believe it's a coincidence that Caitlin is never seen again after her mom drops her off at his house. So let's delve into the events to follow, but the last thing I'll say about that for now is that it seems this reunion at James's house between stepfather and stepdaughter would have been the first time James was alone with Caitlin since she became an adult. The obvious implication is that it's not illegal to solicit her for sex any longer. She is an adult, and it's not taboo because she is technically not biologically related. It is only something that would be unacceptable to the rest of the family, and obviously, we assume, Caitlin, given the result. Now, James has to go to work later on December 5th, around 3:45 p.m. or 4 p.m., so Caitlin is expecting to spend about 4 hours waiting at the airport once her stepfather drops her off. The flight is supposedly departing around 5:40 p.m., while it seems that Lisa dropped Caitlin off in Partlow just prior to 9:30 a.m., so Caitlin is expecting to spend a few hours at James's house before he takes her to the airport, as James again is scheduled to work in Fredericksburg at his job as an insurance salesman starting around 4 p.m. James decides they'll leave for the airport at noon, meaning they'll arrive around 1:30 p.m., which leaves us with the aforementioned 4-hour window. So it seems Caitlin would have been at James's house alone with him from 9:30 a.m. to noon, as far as we know. Just before 2 p.m., Lisa receives a text from James that claims he dropped Caitlin off at the airport. Lisa thanks James and asks how traffic was. James writes back, "Not too bad." Perhaps 10 minutes later, Lisa gets a text from Caitlin that says she's at the airport waiting, but she'll be out of touch for a while because her phone's battery is dying. In my mind, this is already cause for suspicion, because even back in 2015, trying to charge a phone at the airport wasn't exactly a monumental feat. Now, unknown to Lisa at the time, in the 10 minutes between those texts from James and Caitlin, Caitlin had also texted her fiancé Amber in Arizona to say she wasn't coming back that day, that something came up, but she doesn't specify. She only says she's not coming back. But if we compare that to the text Lisa gets 5 minutes later, it's apparent that Caitlin tells her mom she's at the airport waiting to leave, yet ironically tells Amber the opposite, she's not coming back. Now, let's combine those opposing ideals and we'll see the clarity of the truth. Caitlin tells her mom she's leaving and Amber that she's not coming back, which means she only now exists in an inaccessible purgatory between those two places, and simply because that's the only place someone can put her to avoid the truth, for now. So why would she do that? Well, we don't know that she did. We only know that the text messages came from her phone. Who was in possession of it at the time is a different matter. But what I think we need to realize here is that Caitlin, no matter what she has chosen to do here, if she's acting of her own free will, has no obligation to tell everyone in this particular moment. Mom is not expecting her to come back, and Amber isn't expecting her home until much later that day. So in that moment, there simply is no necessity for contacting them to divulge her intentions. Plus, would Caitlin text her fiancé to say, "I'm not coming back today," and break the woman's heart while her phone's battery was about to die and the person she was contacting would be silenced and ignorant for hours? That seems odd, especially given the fact that even law enforcement tells us that Caitlin and her mom and her friends and fiancé were all in regular contact with each other, like every day. So Caitlin is not somebody to avoid contact with other people, even in bad situations. Clearly, whomever actually sent that text realizes the mistake and sends Amber another text thereafter that says she won't be able to text for a bit. Amber feels like something is wrong and calls Caitlin's mom, Lisa, to ask what is happening. This, of course, is when the two of them realize that the text they received conflicted. Lisa calls Caitlin repeatedly, but gets only her voicemail. Now, the heightened concern here is due to the fact that Caitlin is someone who, like most of us, lives on her phone, but is especially known for calling her mom all the time because the two were geographically separated when she moved away to Arizona. Both Amber and Lisa seem to suggest any communication from Caitlin would likely be more substantial, and furthermore, she'd answer her phone if not call right back. For the next few hours, at least four people try to actively contact Caitlin, but fail to reach her directly. When Lisa gets off work, she sends James a text to clarify exactly where he dropped Caitlin at the airport earlier that day. James then drops a bombshell. Lisa assumed Caitlin was taken to the airport because that's what James said by way of text earlier, or at least implied when he explicitly said that he dropped her off and the idea was to take her to the airport. But in this follow-up phone call later in the day, James tells Lisa that he actually dropped Caitlin off at the Springfield Mall. He says she didn't want to sit at the airport for all those hours, so she was going to kill time at the mall. The mall is maybe 20 minutes away from Ronald Reagan Airport, and public transportation, specifically the Metro, connects the two locations. However, Caitlin's family believes she wouldn't have even been familiar with this mall or even know how to ride the Metro. I would agree that Caitlin is probably not amenable to such, as she already chose to go with James instead of using public transportation and did so in a situation that was logistically inefficient. We have to remember, Caitlin is lugging a suitcase around with her. Yes, it's on wheels, but she would have to drag it through the mall for several hours, and also taken on public transportation. Certainly not impossible, but it seems like a burden. Amber gets a Facebook message from Caitlin saying that the reason she can't come back is because she cheated on her. The first thing that strikes Amber about this is that Caitlin is the type to pick up the phone and say these things. She wouldn't send a Facebook message. Plus, the language and formatting of the message, along with the earlier text, struck her as odd, as though it wasn't Caitlin. Caitlin always wrote her texts in paragraphs, all at once, yet this person sent each line individually, something that people say is conducive to the way that James texted. Of course, a lot of other people do that as well, so it certainly doesn't make him guilty. Perhaps 90 minutes after Caitlin's flight was supposed to depart, her mom gets two text messages from her phone. The first states that she's staying with a friend, and the second says that she needs some time alone. Notice the conflict here. She says she needs time alone, but she went to a friend's place to do it. What those texts infer is that she needs some time away from her mother and fiancé and life in general, or that which has expectations of her, so she's basically saying, don't expect me to be responsive or available. She isn't avoiding this unknown friend, but those closest to her instead. What that says to me, given the advantage of retrospect, is that the person doing the texting, who is likely Caitlin's abductor, wants to let people know she'll be gone a while in order to buy himself as much time as possible before a search ensues. If you've discarded a body somewhere and have a corresponding crime scene containing physical evidence, then you need to buy time to cleanse or disguise it. As I talked about much earlier in my episodes, even as long as like 5 years back, we talked about the concept of evolution swarming. It begins to realize that something's wrong, and it reverse engineers and it closes in on the point of origin. And so, if that point of origin is James's house, what he wants to do is keep people away from it as long as possible. So what he's doing here is preventing the swarm. Interestingly enough, even though Caitlin, according to her stepfather James, supposedly spent the hours from 9:30 a.m. to 12 p.m., at his home before they drove to Springfield Mall to drop her off, authorities found no trace of her DNA in this house. Still, James says Caitlin never mentioned meeting a friend that day, but it seemed possible because when Lisa called the airline to learn if her daughter had gotten on the flight, it became apparent the young woman did not. James said he gave Caitlin $20 to use for the Metro, and had specifically dropped her off at JCPenney in front of the Springfield Mall. So the concerned parties follow that lead by making a call to the Metro as well. But it leads nowhere. On Monday, December 7th, Caitlin fails to show up for the first day of school and seemingly never bothered to contact them to let them know she wasn't going to be joining the class after all because of her prolonged absence, which we assume is out of state, away from Arizona, given that she never gets on a plane in Virginia. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. One of the difficulties I find in dealing with my own issues is that, when I feel overwhelmed, I tend to make the problems a focal point instead of what really matters, solutions. And when I get stuck in this place, it reminds me that it's time to take proactive measures in search of the clarity that will take me forward. Even still, sometimes we can't do it alone. We need help on the path to creating a better mindset. I've learned that a therapist can assist in reaching this goal and in turn also improve my awareness of how to manage negativity life throws my way. I was inspired to try therapy initially because of a loss in the family, but soon learned it had benefits beyond the scope of grief, from personal to professional. BetterHelp is affordable, accessible, and best of all, entirely online, making it a wonderful alternative to traditional therapy. A brief survey is all it takes to be matched with a therapist, and you have the option to switch therapists at any time. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/CCMM today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/CCMM. Lisa reports Caitlin missing that day and gets a shock in the process. It turns out Caitlin's suitcase was discovered abandoned on the side of a road near a river, with damage like scuffs and a broken wheel that suggested it was thrown from a moving vehicle. It was actually in a drainage ditch, and a crew of road workers came upon it. They generally work Monday through Friday, so it seems quite possible the suitcase had been there before that day, and these guys just happened to notice it because they were returning to work on Monday after the weekend. Now let's take a quick look at that symbolism. The person driving this vehicle from which the suitcase was tossed is the person we assume interfered with Caitlin. Where is he? Next to a river, symbolic of the mirror universe, or abyss, in which those indulging manifested sociopathic behavior physically submerge that which they desire to become unrealized. A river is essentially a huge ditch full of water, and so we see in the symbolism of the drainage ditch on the side of the road that this becomes the abyss or mirror universe in which the suitcase becomes unrealized, unlike the body. But wait a minute. Now, we can understand a submerged body in water being unrealized. But again, if the suitcase is out in the open, then it's realized, right? Yes, but the point here is that the suitcase itself, in physicality derived from sociopathy, represents not only the internal emotional equivalent of the projected external visual it provides, or mirror, but also what the perpetrator wants this act to accomplish. That's the story the symbolism will tell us. So, what is this suitcase? Baggage. It represents the perpetrator's emotional baggage. And what does he want to do? He wants to leave it behind him on the road of life. As he drives away, he's manifesting the idea of emotional distance from that place. Though parts of that river were searched, it stands to reason Caitlin could have been submerged in an area more distant from the suitcase than the searches covered. We don't know. It's also potentially something the perpetrator might want them to think as part of an effort to misdirect family and law enforcement. Now, this location where the suitcase is dumped is perhaps 50 miles from Ronald Reagan Airport, give or take. Caitlin's wallet and its contents, including her identification, along with cash, debit card, phone charger, and toothbrush, are still inside it, suggesting she wasn't the victim of a robbery. Missing from the suitcase are the clothes, the high school diploma, and the cell phone, though we don't actually know, aside from the clothing, which of these items would have been packed in the suitcase when Caitlin left, and which were placed in there when her belongings were prepared to be discarded. So why would an abductor and or killer take the missing items and leave the rest? Well, I think what we see by leaving the wallet behind, including her ID and debit card, which is tied to her identification, is that the perpetrator is trying to manipulate a circumstance that allows the contents of the suitcase to say, "I don't want to be this person anymore." Leaving behind all things tied to her identification, while taking all of the clothing, along with the diploma, says that she intends to wake up tomorrow, the next day, and so on, to get dressed and live, and keeping the diploma says, even though it has her identity on it, she needs it because she still has dreams for which she might need that thing like she did at the cosmetology school. Keeping the phone without the charger means, just like it did in the text at the airport, but on a grander scale, that she isn't going to be in contact for a while. But she's keeping the phone because one day, soon, she'll want to return. These actions allow hope for those missing her, as it's clear someone made decisions about what stays and what goes, and her choices hold on to just enough to say very clearly, "Don't wait for me, but I'll come home one day when I'm ready." That measured approach is the easiest way to promote apathy on the behalf of concerned parties because it says she wants her space and implores them to give it. The description Caitlin's family gives of her definitely does not indicate a person inclined to such ambiguity and secrecy. To the contrary, she seems to have been someone who would have faced whatever the issue was through explicit communication. I should also mention that this is the Rappahannock River we're talking about, and this incident was on River Road, which branches off from 95. What's interesting is that there's also a reservoir nearby, and while authorities even did helicopter searches of the area, they didn't discover Caitlin's remains. So the police speak with Caitlin's friends, including the couple with whom she had the threesome, in addition to her friend Kevin, and not only learned about this hookup while everybody was drunk, but that Caitlin had contacted Kevin the next day to say she was depressed and crying because of what she did, which we assume to mean cheating on Amber. Now, that almost sounds legitimate in terms of a reason to run off and start a new life, because the shame of the act is fresh. But there's an issue here. This was conveyed to Kevin through texting, and it's suspected someone took control of Caitlin's phone, which means the person who acquired it would also have access to those texts, allowing him to formulate a scenario in which it looks like that was the reason Caitlin was in a hurry to run off. That's when the police also learn that Caitlin had messaged a friend on Facebook the morning of her disappearance to suggest that she didn't want to be in Virginia, but also didn't want to go back to Arizona, which we assume is because she feels the need to face Amber with the truth. But notice her character there. She feels obligated to go back and tell the truth, which is exactly what makes the idea of returning a terrible thought. She feels guilty and is, at that time, stuck in an emotional purgatory between what she did and what the consequences will be. So she expresses that she doesn't want to be in Virginia and doesn't want to be in Arizona either. The people she loves there aren't the problem. It's what those locations symbolize. Virginia is where she made a big mistake, and Arizona is where the consequences of that wrongdoing will come to bear. The only place she's safe at that time, on an emotional level, is one where she's suspended between in a purgatory. Emotionally, she wants the comfort of being in that womb, a place where she's protected from what's chasing her and what lies ahead. That's exactly how depression happens. Emotional movement from one place to another ceases due to fear of what we'll lose, and soon after implores reduction of physical movement until we're stuck and unable to go back or move forward. Some people literally lie in bed wrapped in a blanket like a cocoon when they're depressed and won't get up. It's become a favorite in TV and film as a means of expressing that idea visually in the absence of direct emotional insight. We all know the scene where the drunk, depressed person is put in the shower while clothed to get them moving again. It manifests the cleansing of who you were for who you are. It's symbolic rebirth. Yet in this case, Caitlin is experiencing it emotionally and has even left those sentiments in writing on her phone and social media messages, so if somebody acquires that phone, all they need to do is mirror her emotional desires in physicality, because guess what? If these two people converge, it means it's because they're both stuck in the same place emotionally. So when Caitlin expresses that she doesn't want to go forward and doesn't want to go back either, her abductor uses those emotional ideas manifested in physicality to say the same, as we discussed with the contents of her luggage. She literally does not stay with her mom in Virginia and does not go back to Amber in Arizona. She's somewhere in between. To match what happened emotionally, meaning losing herself or the person she expects to be by cheating on Amber, her fiancé, she physically gets lost in between the place where she committed the act and the one where she would face the consequences. We all desire to disappear emotionally in that place sometimes, specifically to avoid change, and even more specifically, change in the form of loss. If you go home and tell your fiancé you had a threesome and it was something that had you depressed and crying, it means you believe something is going to change moving forward, and not for the better. How do we define that? Emotionally, Caitlin is going to hurt someone, meaning Amber. So the perpetrator in this case merely has to manifest a physical circumstance in which he, to the contrary, gains something by Caitlin never going back to Amber to tell the truth. He'll give her the physical version of what she wants. It's tragic fate. She's relieved of the responsibility to Amber and enduring the fallout, but the cost is the opposite of what she had expected. Instead of emotional, it's physical and in the form of death. That's the peace that she'll receive. Or at least at this point, she has disappeared. This is how the narcissistic sociopath justifies his violent actions and lures people into his web. He aligns his physical desires with the emotional desires of the victim, so the victim ends up getting what she wants in the worst way, but is emotionally freed from the responsibility of her issue. The narcissistic killer sees himself as the one who must employ wrath physically in order to provide the peace or mercy that the victim is seeking emotionally. The key to doing that is getting inside the victim's emotional life through manipulation and charm. But here, the predator or perpetrator has Caitlin's emotions in writing. It allows him to easily craft a roadmap to a place that says she ran away because, quite simply, that is how she was feeling that day. She wanted to disappear. She did, in the worst possible way, physically rather than emotionally. That's the work of a sociopath. Now, law enforcement doesn't have Caitlin's phone, but when they're able to acquire her cell records, they quickly ascertain that Caitlin wasn't at the airport when she texted her mom to say she arrived there and her phone was dying. Apparently, that text was sent only about 5 miles from where the suitcase was later discovered. The phone records allow the cops to determine that Caitlin wasn't in the places it was believed that afternoon, and so it seemed James was lying. Worse, he specifically told law enforcement that Caitlin was dropped off in front of JCPenney at the Springfield Mall, but surveillance, CCTV, captures nothing of the sort. Not James's vehicle, not Caitlin, and of course, not James either, which, when combined with the inconsistency between his word and the phone records, doesn't give him much breathing room for appearing innocent in this matter. Ultimately, surveillance from the metro, the mall, and the airport never reveal Caitlin. At the time James said he was dropping Caitlin at the mall, many miles from his home, his phone pinged by his house instead. Detectives are like, "Bro, can we get you in here for a polygraph?" And James agrees. On the day of the test, he contacts them to say his attorney advised him to not take the polygraph. Furthermore, the police are unable to access the encrypted contents of James's phone, and he refuses to provide the password, so they don't have a clear picture of exactly what is on this device, though we can assume it's nothing good, given his refusal. All of the pings from James's phone that fateful day came from around his home. And while the police aren't able to crack the encryption on his phone, encryption that he installed himself, what they can do is look at his phone records. Even though Caitlin allegedly disappeared after he dropped her off somewhere and never returned, James made exactly zero calls or texts to Caitlin's phone on the day of the vanishing and thereafter. He showed no concern for her disappearance. Supposedly, James told Lisa that he did, in fact, go to work for his scheduled shift on the day of the disappearance around 3:45 or 4 p.m., but investigators soon learned that wasn't true. James did not go to work. He called and said he was sick. Now, what's interesting here is that Caitlin did have some type of texting app on her phone that permitted encrypted messages, but it seems apparent she wasn't using it at the time, and somebody other than Caitlin was able to access her messages. I think this is fairly simple. If you were 19, sexually active, engaged, cheating, and had cheated in the past, you might, in certain circumstances, such as contacting people outside your relationship with your significant other, decide to encrypt those messages for privacy purposes. So, is it possible Caitlin walked off to be with someone else, or even to be alone? Sure, it's possible. But to believe that, you have to ignore the fact that James lied. Now, remember how I said the perpetrator would be in the same place emotionally as the victim here, and that Caitlin felt like she couldn't go forward, yet also couldn't go back because she was depressed and crying? Well, guess who never goes back to his job, ever, after calling out of work sick that day that Caitlin vanished? James. And guess who doesn't move forward in life afterward, choosing to not work again for 7 months? James. And it turns out that, according to the family, James has a history of suffering depression and anger problems. In truth, James didn't even contact the insurance company to tell them he wasn't coming back to work, to tell them that it was over. He just ran away in silence. Because guess what? That's who he is, not Caitlin. And I believe it's why those texts suggest she wasn't writing them. The last bit of intrigue here, as the suspicion falls upon James without definitive proof of wrongdoing other than lying repeatedly about the events of that day, is two cell phone pings. One ping from James's phone at his home on the afternoon of the disappearance, and another near the discarded luggage at the same time that came from Caitlin's phone. James obviously can't be in two places at once, in possession of both phones, which, combined with the suggestion of the suitcase being thrown out of a moving vehicle, hints at a possibility of multiple assailants, most likely two. Some have suggested James's mother might have assisted him in the aftermath of a terrible mistake in which he lost control. But I think a closer look here reveals that one perpetrator was at fault. What I think is most likely here is that the perpetrator left his phone at home when discarding the body and luggage so that only Caitlin's phone would ping in the area of the suitcase. It didn't ping by her body, of course, and I believe because it was likely turned off at that time, hence the warning about the battery dying and nobody being able to contact Caitlin for a bit. I think that's the time in which the phone was turned off because the perpetrator doesn't want anyone to know where the body is, of course. But once that was taken care of, the phone is turned back on when discarding the luggage and pings in that spot as the perpetrator intended. What these actions do, to the best of their ability, is put James at home while Caitlin is supposedly discarding her luggage elsewhere. But the folly in it is that we can only account for the phones being in those places at those times and not the people. During normal usage, cell phones generally don't ping local towers if they're turned off. So I speculate that he leaves home without his phone, which is powered on, and takes hers, which is turned off, at which point he gets rid of the body before going to dump the suitcase, an area where he also turns Caitlin's phone back on. It pings in that place, and he then subsequently turns it off because he's going back home, at which point he arrives back to his phone, which has pinged at his home all day to suggest he was present there. Apparently, James was fairly technologically savvy, but we have to admit here that you can't be in two places at once. So it is very difficult to perpetrate any suggestion of Caitlin and James being in different places and alive at the same time beyond the phones. Can't prove it by way of people. It's only the phone pings because simply that's all that was possible. I think what happened that day is that Caitlin went into his home, depressed and vulnerable, and James probably got her talking after realizing she was upset in the 2.5 hours they had before needing to go to the airport. The reason abusive people like to get their victims to open up and become vulnerable emotionally is that it builds a level of trust for when they cross the line into physicality. If you listen and care, then it creates a facade that you're a gentle person who means no harm. That doesn't make people automatically do things they don't want to do, but it does put them in a state of mind in which they will be most likely to cooperate. Still, it would have been a huge risk for James to cross the line, and depending how far he might have gone across it, there might have been no going back at that point. Once a person's reputation and/or freedom are at stake, desperation arises, and that desperation can lead to decisions much worse than intended with their original action. Overcompensation becomes necessary to make things right. In this case, I believe the most probable outcome, given James's lies, is that he murdered Caitlin when his bold sexual advance went wrong in unforeseen ways. There is evidence she went to his home that day. There is no evidence she left, at least not alive. There is nothing here to definitively implicate James in a court of law, but there is physical evidence in the form of video surveillance and phone records to prove he lied about circumstances related to Caitlin Aiken's whereabouts on a day she vanished and was never seen again. Unfortunately, we might never know the truth. But I would guess that in those 7 months of hiding between jobs, when James had all the time in the world to look at his reflection in the mirror, he finally saw who he really was. the monster. And when he realized it, just like most people who are depressed, he was terrified to come out again and show his face, because everyone else would see it too.